Okay, says it's 10 o'clock now, so even though the bells haven't gone off, let me start the lecture. There are two things I want to do in the lecture today. First is in response to strong demand from the class, I want to talk a little bit about the midterm exam on Friday. And the other thing is I want to kind of review what we've covered in the first half of the course, this whole period from July 1914 through December 1941, especially with a view to what's to be taken away from a study of this whole period. You know, what's important about what we've covered so far? Okay, so first, the midterm. Be sure to bring a blue book. I think most of you know this already, but I just want to make sure that everyone comes with a blue book. What will the midterm cover? I think I talked about this in the very first class, and I know I had it on the syllabus. But let me go into it again in somewhat greater detail, okay? No essay questions. Remember, you probably don't remember, the first President Bush, when he was running for president in 1988, he had this famous thing, read my lips, no new taxes. And I say, read my lips, no essay questions. It's like, I promise you, I still get people asking me, are there going to be essay questions on the exam? No. Why no essay questions? Because it's so easy to BS your way through an essay question. It's not a valid test of how well you've absorbed the material, right? And so the exam is going to be full of either you know it or you don't sorts of questions, where there's not that much room for the subjective judgment on the part of the grader. You say it's like very clear whether you know things. So the very first question will be putting the main events that we've covered in the course in chronological order. Why is this important? Just because I think, you know, that kind of basic command of the history is important as an end in itself. I'll get to you in just a sec. No, it's because your understanding of the chronology is a measure of your understanding of much more important substantive points. For example, it's important that you know that the Peace Without Victory speech came before the United States entered the First World War, because it's important that you realize that that policy was dropped as soon as the United States did intervene in the First World War, and that Wilson opted for a very different policy. So your understanding of the chronology is a measure of how well you've absorbed that fundamental point. Similarly, I promise I haven't forgotten you. Similarly, you should know that the Nazi-Soviet pact came right before the outbreak of the Second World War, right? It's important that you know that, because this was a part of Hitler's effort to deter Britain and France from intervening on behalf of Poland. This was a, you know, major card that he was playing, you know, to convince Britain and France that it was hopeless for them to kind of go to the aid of Poland. He was taking away their Soviet option. It shows that what he wanted was not so much a war with Britain and France, but to kind of deter them from intervening militarily in the conflict with Poland that Hitler had decided on, right? Similarly, and I'll give you another important examples. It's important that you know that The German attack on the Soviet Union, June 1941, preceded the oil embargo, because the oil embargo represented a toughening of American policy that can only be understood in the context of the new situation created by the prospect of a possible German conquest of the USSR. It's important that you understand that the oil embargo preceded Pearl Harbor, right? Yeah, for all the obvious reasons. So the chronology tests your command of the substance. That's why there's going to be that first question in the chronology. Not all kinds of obscure things, but the basic stuff, the basic events that played such a key role in the story. Okay, I'm sorry to keep you waiting, but you have a question. What date to what date for the midterm? Is that the question? June 28th, 1914? The beginning of the July crisis? Assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand? I'm not going to ask you, you know, the assassination of Franz Ferdinand. But do you want precise answers? June 28th, 1914 through December 11th, 1941. Not December 7th, 1941. December 11th, 1941. Why? Because December 11th is the date that Germany declared war on the United States. Right. But roughly, from the beginning of the First World War to the outbreak of the Pacific War, to America's entry in World War II. All right? Yes.
Should you also be memorizing the specific dates and years?
You don't have to know the dates. It's just putting things in order. See, it's so easy. If you've been following the course and doing your work, this stuff should be a piece of cake. Yes?
And is this one of those questions where if you get one of them out of order, the entire question is
no.
Wrong?
No. The answer to that is, the way it will be graded is the minimum number of changes that would have to be made in order to put something in the correct order. If you put something in space C and it should go in space H, that's only one change. And you'll be docked only for the number of points that correspond to that one change. So if there, I haven't figured it out yet, I haven't written the exam yet, but if there are 15 events to be put in chronological order and this part of the exam counts for 30 points out of 100, then each thing that you have out of order, you'll be docked for 2 points, right? So instead of getting 30, if we have to move, say, three things, you'll be docked for 6 points and you get 24. Okay? What could be fairer than that? Yeah?
Will we be asked questions about events that occur in different months but in the same year?
So yes.
Okay.
Like I just gave you two examples of that, right? The Nazi-Soviet pact and the outbreak of the war, and the three examples from 1941, three events in 1941. Yeah, sometimes, you know, the fact that something is just a few months earlier is, like, really important. Yeah?
So just to clarify, you're going to give us the events and we put it in order?
Right. I'll have it all jumbled up, right? So why are you laughing?
I thought we had to write down every event that happened.
Oh, no. What do you take me for? I'm not your enemy on this. I would like nothing better than for everyone in the class to get an A+. My wife sometimes, she would give my grades A++++. I remember that. I never had the guts to do anything like that, but... But no. It's the whole idea is the minimum you need to show me that you've absorbed this basic stuff. I don't expect anything arcane. You know, it's like what are these important things? You know, it's like Locarno, Rapallo, Versailles. You know, the remilitarization of the Rhineland, the Munich conference, the outbreak of the First World War, outbreak of the Second World War, peace without victory speech. You know, the Ruhr crisis. It's kind of obvious what all the main things are: Pearl Harbor, German fall of France, German attack on the Soviet Union. You know, just, you know, not hard to do. I have another piece of advice for everybody. I don't know if you saw the little thing in the Daily Bruin website. Who's the Daily Bruin reporter who interviewed me? He asked me how to talk with him about how people could prepare for midterm exams. And then this colleague of mine, Tom Schwartz, came by, and so the three of us had this little conversation. He put it online on the Daily Bruin website. But basically, what I was saying, you know what the key thing to preparing for an exam is? You get together among yourselves in little study groups. You know, the people that you're sitting next to, you know, just at the end of the class, just turn, if you don't have a study group already, just turn the people sitting close to you so you want to get together. And what do you do in the study groups? Is you try and figure out, you know, psych me out. Figure out what the questions are gonna be based on what I'm telling you now, what I said in the syllabus, and so on. And then ask each other those questions, and then see what the answers are, because you'll have plenty of time to look at things. All right. So I told you so far about the first question. Then I'm gonna ask you questions about, like true or false things, you know, really kind of really basic stuff. Did Hitler consider the Munich Conference a victory? Right. Important things that that we've covered in the course. Questions about why did a Russian general mobilization lead to the outbreak of war? And there it's the whole logic of the situation established by the Schlieffen Plan. Everyone should understand this sort of thing, that Germany has to reach a quick decision, a relatively quick outcome of the war, victory in the war, because Germany is a relatively small country, and she's taking on these three great empires with control of the seas and so on. But Germany has this one big advantage, namely that she can mobilize her forces much more quickly, especially than Russia. Russia's much more primitive. And what this means is that there's a certain window of opportunity for Germany at the very beginning of the war. She doesn't have to protect her eastern border with large forces, because Russia is mobilizing so slowly. Germany can then concentrate all of her forces, because she mobilizes quickly, on her western border, throw them against France, marching through Belgium, knock France out of the war, and then pivot around to deal with Russia. Right, that's Germany's only hope for avoiding a war of attrition and winning the war relatively quickly. That's called the Schlieffen Plan. All right, what this means is a Russian general mobilization. Germany can't just sit on her hands and not mobilize and in fact attack France, because if Germany allows the Russian mobilization to run its course, then Germany is going to have to divide her forces, allocate much more of her army to the defense of her eastern border to deal with this mobilizing Russia, and therefore weaken the force that she could throw against France, and thus compromise her chances of knocking France out at the beginning of the war. Right? So Germany can't wait. So a Russian general mobilization leads to a German mobilization, and in fact to war. Right, that's the whole point about interacting mobilizations. Right, stuff like that. Same sort of thing about the logic of the situation established by the oil embargo. Why was it? Here's a typical question. Why was it that the oil embargo put the United States and Japan on a collision course? Answer is, the Japanese need the oil for military purposes. You know, because otherwise, without liquid fuels, their military effort in China would collapse. How can Japan get the oil? One of two ways, either through a negotiated agreement with the United States that allows the oil deliveries to resume, because America is speaking not just for herself, but also for the other two major oil exporters, British Empire and the Dutch. Either through a negotiated agreement with the United States, or by seizing the oil fields in the Dutch East Indies. Japan, but the Americans make it clear that the Japanese move to seize the oil-producing areas in the Indies would lead to a war with America. And so if you want to avoid both the collapse of your position in China or war with the United States, you need an agreement. But then what were the terms of the American agreement? Japan would have to basically capitulate on the China issue. You know, very extreme terms. Japan would have to pull out totally and virtually immediately from China. Right? So Japan's in a corner. Japan, the Japanese are faced with a choice between capitulation on China or a war with America. It's like, why is this stuff important to understand? Because it shows you that the Pearl Harbor attack is not to be understood as a bolt from the blue, or that the entry of the United States into the war is to be understood as a product of this war-crazed, lunatic Japanese, pure and simple. It shows you that there are political factors at work here that most people in the United States have no understanding of. Did you have a question? I saw your hand up. No? Okay. Stuff like that. The logic of these various situations that are created. What was Stresemann's basic policy? What was Wilson's basic policy? How does Stresemann's policy differ from Hitler's? You know, what was the essence of the Versailles system? What were the main provisions of the Treaty of Versailles? What were the main provisions of the Treaty of Locarno? Which two powers signed the Treaty of Rapallo? You know, these are things either you know it or you don't. And you're responsible for things that are said in lecture, even if they're not covered in the readings, or mentioned in the readings, even if they're not covered in the lectures. Not every detail. I'm not going to ask you these kind of, questions about the Spanish Civil War or the nature of the sanctions that were applied on Italy with regard to the Ethiopian War, any things like that. You know, but the big things, the important things that relate to the whole course of great power politics, all right? So there'd be questions of that sort. You know, but basic factual things that don't call for any interpretation on your part. What else? Oh yeah, a very important part of the exam is going to consist of questions about the readings. And the readings, I don't mean the Sontag book, which is kind of like a text. I don't want you to worry about telling me what the basic argument of the Sontag book is. But the other readings that we have. My article on 1914, the Kennan article about America's entry into the war, the Taylor book, the Utley book. And here, what I want you to do is to use that method I outlined in the first class and then showed you how it works in the lecture last Friday on the Taylor book. I want you to use that method to simply identify arguments, the core argument of these works. So that if you're asked, what's the core argument of such and such a book or article, you should be able to say what it is in like three or four sentences. Okay? You don't have to give your own opinion of it. You don't have to analyze it or criticize it or talk about its flaws or weaknesses. As a matter of fact, they don't want you to do that. It's just a very simple exercise of telling me what the arguments are, because it's just the first step. You'd be surprised how many people have trouble even with that first step. Right? But I want people to kind of at least learn that method for figuring out what an author is driving at. So the method was outlined in very great detail, and I showed you how it works in the lecture on Taylor. So take that and apply that method to your analysis of the Utley book, which also has a very sharp argument. In fact, a disturbing argument if you accept it. Or to the Taylor piece, or to my thing on 1914. Okay, I think, I think that that pretty much covers it. It's basically important things, but probably things that you didn't know before you took this class, and things and questions which would have a kind of either you know it or you don't sort of flavor. So you'll have 50 minutes to do the exam. That should be more than enough time. I think a lot of people will finish in around after only half an hour or so. Okay. So, do any of you have questions now about the midterm, or is it all abundantly clear? Yes.
So the short answer for the book or the readings, is it all short answers?
Well, if I ask you a question about the basic argument of a particular work that we've read, three or four sentences. Now, do you call that a short answer?
Sort of.
All right. So that's your answer. I'm not asking you to write an essay on the Taylor book, because it's like, don't forget, read my lips. No essay questions. Yes. Did I say this in the syllabus? I guess not. A third. Three components of the course, right? The midterm and the two parts of the final. The in-class part and the take-home part. And then the final will be pretty much the same sort of format. The in-class part of the final is the same format as the midterm. The take-home will be literally what you'll just be asked. What's to be taken away from all the work you did in this class? That's the essay question, so to speak. The take-home final. What have you drawn from the work that you've done in the course of the quarter that could serve as a source of insight into the question of how should foreign policy be conducted? Okay, so, but we'll worry about that later. Because, as I say, the key thing is like study groups. Okay, was there another hand? I thought I saw another hand. No? You? Okay. What I want to do today is try and pull together a lot of the stuff that we've covered in the quarter so far, the first half of the quarter. What's to be taken away from all of these things that we've been talking about? We're concerned with these central questions in the study of international relations. This basic question of what makes for war, or conversely, what makes for a stable international system? And then somewhat derivative question of, so what makes for good foreign policy? And I say it's derivative because the question of what sort of policy should be pursued is intimately connected to the question of what causes war. Because the good policies, the policies that you want to pursue, are policies that allow you to achieve your objectives without having to go to war for them. All right? And we're trying to get at that issue by reacting to the ideas that we find around us, both in the general culture and in the scholarly literature. And you ask people, or you look at the way these issues are analyzed, and most people, if you say, well, what causes war, they'll say, well, that's very straightforward. Wars are caused by aggressors. You know, you want to figure out what caused a particular conflict, that boils down into an exercise in figuring out who to blame. Okay? And there's another view that we find, especially in the scholarly literature, saying, well, maybe that's not quite the case. Maybe you can't just always blame aggressors for a conflict. Because isn't it possible that sometimes, you know, people just lose control of events? That countries just stumble into wars without thinking about what they're doing? that wars can break out even though no bone really wants it. I mean, essentially by accident. Okay. And all of these ideas have had very important political consequences. For example, the notion that war is to be understood as the product of aggression lies at the heart of the basic American strategy that was pursued during the Cold War period, the strategy of deterrence, because it's aggression and only aggression that you're seeking to deter. Right. And on the other hand, a lot of what went on, especially in the areas of arms control, those policies were based on the notion that wars can break out because of countries losing control over policy because of these forces just welling up from within the military sphere. I quoted you from Barbara Tuchman, generals banging their fists on the table, demanding the signal to go first. You know, all this emphasis on getting the jump on your adversaries, getting the advantages of the first strike. Right? And so the idea was, if you want to stabilize the system, you want to create a sort of force structure which eliminates the incentive to go first. By creating a force structure where there's no advantage to going first, because whether you go first or you only retaliate, the damage that you suffer is going to be pretty much the same. All right. So those ideas, those basic ideas, are very important. But are they valid? All right. That's our question. And I guess one of the basic arguments I wanted to make to you is that there's a third way of approaching the whole issue of what makes for war. And that's to see war, not in moral terms, as a result of an evil aggressor, you know, pressing the button and starting a war, yeah, but in political terms, as a result of a political conflict, as the climax of a political process that unfolds over time, over the space of years, in fact, sometimes of decades, a process with a certain internal logic to it, where one thing leads to another, where that logic depends to a very considerable extent on power factors, considerations having to do with the structure of power. Not that power is all there is to this story, because statecraft also matters. But no one is entirely a free agent. Policies are constrained because national leaders have to worry about the security of their countries, and therefore they have to pay attention to power realities, both as they exist at the time and how they're developing over time, right? And this notion that warfare is to be understood as the product of a political process implies that the moral judgments that you would make about the different policies that were pursued, different strategies that were adopted, they're somewhat problematic. Lots of times it's very hard to figure out who's right and who's wrong. And in fact, part of the art of studying these things is being able to look at these situations through the eyes of both sides in a conflict. A good example of that is the conflict over Versailles and the immediate post-1919 period. You say, who's right and who's wrong? Were the Germans wrong for resisting the Versailles settlement? You can understand why they wanted to do it. In large part, because countries wanted some control over their own destiny. And if German power is kept down, the Germans aren't really able to defend themselves. They obviously want to throw off what they called the shackles of Versailles, especially since the Versailles settlement had such was so fraught with moral importance. Right? It was based on the idea that the Germans were criminals, that they caused the war. Can understand why the Germans would want to resist something like that. On the other hand, you could also understand why the French would want to retain the Versailles system, you know, because if you do away with these constraints on German power, the essence of the Versailles system, Germany would overwhelm France. Germany would be more powerful vis-a-vis France than she had been even in 1914. In which case, what was the point of fighting the war? So you can understand what is a political conflict. You can't say, well, one side's right, the other side is wrong. Right? That's something important. Now, that whole approach, it's essentially a framework for analysis. You take that set of ideas, that power is of fundamental importance, that the logic of power is the key to understanding the course of events, right? And you apply it to these particular historical cases. And you want to see in each particular historical context how far you could push it. In other words, how much sense you can make out of the story. To what degree is the story to be understood in rational terms, in terms of statesmen deeply concerned by these power political problems, you know, policies constrained by these power political realities, trapped almost by the situation in which they find themselves. To what extent can you push that interpretation, and to what extent does it fall short in other kinds of factors, statecraft especially, the political choices that are made, to what extent do they come into play, right? And when you're grappling with these issues, it's very important to analyze them within the framework of international relations theory, right? Because there are basic sets of ideas about all of these issues. How is international politics to be interpreted? What constitutes correct policy, and so on? And the two great clusters of ideas in this field are realism and liberalism. If you haven't had Poli-Sci 20 and you haven't had anyone who's told you about what realism is and so on, simple solution, look it up on the Wikipedia. Realism, it's not a theory, it's basically a sensibility. It's, the basic idea is that power is of fundamental importance in international political life. Right, it's some people, soft realists, would say it's a very important factor. Others would say it's the key factor. It's the determining factor in international political life. But basically, it stresses the importance of power, and it also is connected with the normative notion that policy should be based on an awareness of those power political factors and not on moral considerations, not on ideological considerations. The other great school of thought, the liberal school of thought, takes the opposite view, saying, well, real peace can't just be based on an equilibrium of power. It has to have a more fundamental basis. You have to have a true community of nations based on shared values. And, of course, the values that they're thinking of sharing are liberal values. You know, it's a Woodrow Wilson, great exemplar of the liberal philosophy, you know, fight the First World War to make the world safe for democracy, very famous phrase from that period. And so a basic approach that we took in this part of the course is to try and get at these issues by looking at historical interpretations that have a certain resonance in the context of those international relations ideas. Interpretations about how war can come kind of by accident, even though nobody wants it. Well, we looked at the main historical case that's given to support those claims, the July crisis of 1914, the whole business of the interacting mobilization system as a cause of the war. I gave a lecture on that. Yeah, you read my article on this subject. You could see that there's a method here. The method is to look at historical claims that are crucial to supporting these theoretical arguments, then examining those historical claims both in the light of the evidence and also with a view to their own internal logic. Now you reach your conclusions about the historical interpretations, and automatically that'll tell you something about the general theoretical issue. Right? Same sort of thing about Versailles and the Wilson policy during the period of the First World War. A key finding there, which I hope you were shocked by, I mean, I still remember how shocking I found it, was that contrary to what we're taught in high schools about how Wilson was the great champion of a moderate peace of reconciliation with Germany, and his desire to achieve that sort of peace was thwarted by these kind of imperialistic Europeans who insisted on thinking in old-fashioned balance of power terms, it turns out that Wilson was a great champion of a punitive peace. Not an accident for someone who thought of international politics in moralistic terms. You know, if America was forced to go into the war, it was because Germany is a criminal country. A criminal country, if the war is a crime, well, the criminal should be punished for that. How else could you justify yourself in terms of fundamental principles of justice and rule of law and so on? You know, it's like, over and over again, Wilson spoke in punitive terms. Right? You saw those Wilson speeches, especially that first speech in the course pack about how we got to crush Germany. This is not peace without victory. Peace without victory goes by the boards as soon as America enters the war. Well, that tells you something about the whole, liberal approach in general, doesn't it? And then you look at the peace conference, and I spent two lectures analyzing the peace conference, both of the, in terms of the general policies of the three victor powers, and also issue by issue, because there's a really important puzzle here that you should grapple with. This Versailles peace, this peace of 1919, it was the only great peace settlement in all of human history to be dictated by democratic powers, by the three great Western democracies, and by them alone. You don't find that in 1815, you don't find that in 1945. And yet it was also by far the least stable settlement of a great power war in the history, modern history of great power politics. Right, much less stable than 1815, much less stable than 1945. How are we to explain that? Important point, because everyone thinks, oh, well, democracy makes for good policy. Democratic powers pursue the right kind of foreign policy and so on. Well, doesn't it suggest that maybe the opposite is the case? Okay, important points. Then we looked at the post-World War I period. It's a clash. The clash is totally understandable. It's not because of the harshness of the treaty. The treaty settlement was less harsh than what was imposed on Germany after 1945. Germany was left as a sovereign state. Germany was left unified, intact. The problem was that whereas in 1945, Germany had no chance of resisting the peace settlement because the forces arrayed against her were so incredibly powerful compared to the power that Germany had. And Germany, threatened by the Soviet Union after 1945, was forced into dependence on the Western powers, Britain, France, and the United States, for protection. Right? And therefore, there was a limit to how far the Germans could go in pushing for their purely nationalistic goals. They had to trim their sails to what the Americans basically were willing to accept. Not so after 1919. The forces arrayed against Germany were relatively weak. You know, Russia doesn't count for anything. Russia's excluded from Central Europe by this new Polish state that separates Germany from Russia, hostile to uh, to the Soviets and tied to the West. So that shields Germany from Russia even after Russian power revives. And as far as the Western democracies are concerned, they basically defect from the Versailles system in 1920. And now they're putting all this pressure on the French to not enforce it. So what are the forces keeping Germany alive? Just this weakened France. And the French are held back by their sense that ultimately their security depends on good relations with the Anglo-Saxons, who don't want France to act in a unilateral way. And so you have, those forces aren't quite enough to get the French to just throw in the towel and say, it's hopeless, we have no choice but to accept the full resurgence of German power and the collapse of the Versailles system. So you have this conflict. This conflict. And what issue does the conflict focus on? The issue where the Versailles system is most vulnerable. This is the reparation question. That's why reparations play such an important role in the post-war period. Not because these economic issues are truly fundamental importance in themselves, because what's at stake there in the conflict over reparations is whose power is going to dominate Europe. Is the Versailles system going to be maintained intact, or is it going to be thrown off and Germany will then reemerge as the number one power on the continent of Europe? Right? That's what this is about. And we talked about this a bit and how it culminated in the Ruhr occupation, Ruhr crisis of 1923, how that crisis ended with France basically snatching defeat from the jaws of victory, is the way I put it. And how France's defeat didn't mean that the path was clear, full speed ahead for Germany, build up her power and so on. Germany was also constrained because Germany, for various reasons, was dependent on the goodwill of Britain and America, in large part for financial reasons. And so you have this post-Ruhr period of apparent détente. This is the Locarno period. It's, the era of hope, or some people call it the era of illusion. Yeah. The hope was that Germany and the Western powers had buried the hatchet, that they had left the white waters and had entered into the blue seas of perpetual peace. Right? But it was all based on a misconception. The Germans hadn't truly reconciled themselves to the post-war status quo. They were willing to play along with what the Western powers wanted to a certain extent, because this was necessary to get the West to kind of dismantle the Versailles system. But the Germans continued to resist, although in a less direct, more subtle sort of way. But when it became clear that that Germany was resisting and the Locarno policy wasn't working, what were the Western powers to do? Go back to the policy of force? That was bankrupt. They had no choice, they felt, but to continue along the path that they had entered into at Locarno and hope for the best. And so you have all these great events. The removal of military control from Germany in 1927, the evacuation of the Rhineland ahead of schedule in 1930, the granting to Germany of equality of rights in the matter of arms in December of 1932. The Versailles system is dead before Hitler comes to power in January of 1933. Right? Very important point. The problems had not been solved. Proof? The French had decided to build a line of fortifications across northern France in 1929, before the Depression even, the Maginot Line. If France and Germany were at peace, what's the point of that, right? It's because they weren't at peace that you had to do this. All right? Does this mean that Hitler's coming to power made no difference? Obviously not. It's an extremely perverse argument to claim that that was the case. Stresemann, German policy in the late 20s, this is not a policy of Germany pursuing good neighborly relations with France of the sort of policy that Germany pursued after World War II. Stresemann was not Adenauer. He wanted to throw off Versailles, wanted to build up German power. When German power got built up, he was going to insist on important changes in the status quo. In large part, the return to 1914, including even ultimately getting back Alsace-Lorraine. Right? But that doesn't mean there was no difference between Stresemann and Hitler. Hitler's goals were much more far-reaching. You know, transforming Germany into a world power, a contiguous land empire in Europe, based on the conquest of these vast territories in the east, especially in Ukraine. All right, ultimate goal. What do you want from the Western powers? You know, proceeded cautiously at first, but it gradually became clear, you know, that he was pursuing expansionist policy. A great pivotal moment for Germany is 1936, remilitarization of the Rhineland. Everyone should know why that was an important event in terms of how it changed the strategic situation there. When it became clear that the Western powers were willing to give Germany certain alleviations, providing that they were done peacefully, including territorial changes, but not to give Germany a totally free hand in the East, Hitler turned against the West, and it's the meaning of the Hossbach meeting in November of 37, and came to the conclusion that a war with Britain and France was inevitable. But in the relatively distant future, 43 to 45 is the period he had in mind. And in the meantime, you got to clear the decks in the East. Hence the Austrian annexation in early 38, the crisis with Czechoslovakia in late 1938. The question for the West was, how far is Hitler going to go? Was he going to just accept the creation of a great German state, or was he going to move yet further? The key thing here was that in March of 39, the Germans take over the rest of Czechoslovakia, areas that were not inhabited by ethnic Germans. And this led to this dramatic change in British attitudes. You know, appeasement was totally discredited. The British shifted to a policy of resistance. There had to be some line drawn. And that's why the British took the strongest stand that they did in the Polish crisis, when Hitler was moving to change the situation with regard to Poland. So Hitler didn't want a war with the West over Poland. It was premature from his point of view. And the West didn't actually want a war with Hitler. Each side is trying to out-deter the other by taking stronger and stronger positions. But the more strongly you take a stand, the harder it is to pull back. And so you have this war of 1939 breaking out, a war that Hitler didn't want at that time. He had been trapped by a process that he himself had done so much to trigger. Not the end of the story. The war breaks out. A key event here is the fall of France in June of 1940, leading to a transformation of American policy. The Americans had come to think Britain can't be allowed to fall. But Roosevelt is held back by domestic political considerations. Hitler sees that this is the case, that America is moving toward intervention, meaning that Hitler has only a certain window of opportunity to kind of clear the decks before the Americans intervene. He has to make Germany invulnerable before America intervenes. This is why he decides to invade the Soviet Union when he does. Okay, this German attack on the Soviet Union changes the American calculus. It means that the Americans now have a window of opportunity. They have to get involved in this war before the Germans are able to bring order out of chaos in the areas that they're conquering at Russia's expense. Right? And so you find a quickening of the pace as far as the Americans are concerned. A much harder policy vis-a-vis Germany. This is the period of the undeclared naval war in the North Atlantic. But that doesn't do the trick because Hitler doesn't respond to these provocations. But Roosevelt has a second string in his bow, and he can use the situation with Japan as a means for getting the Americans involved in the war. is this, I think, and this is speculative more than these other things that I've been saying, this, I think, is why he pursued the policy he did, a policy of putting the United States on a collision course with Japan in 1941. And it's that policy that led directly to the attack on Pearl Harbor and the outbreak of the Pacific War and America's entry into the European conflict 4 days later. Yes.
How did Roosevelt know that Germany will come to Japan's aid?
Oh, we talked about that last time. We're out of time now. It's 10 minutes to, but I'll explain that to you right after class. Okay. So don't forget blue books, study groups. See you in class on Friday. Okay.
The magic.
Okay.
Yeah. The magic system.